Hey everybody, just a couple of PSAs before this podcast gets started. First, we had some audio technical issues with the first half of the podcast, so bear with it, it's not that bad. Our audio quality isn't great anyway, but you might notice a difference. And also, if you want to avoid One Piece manga spoilers, you can jump to 39 minutes and 15 seconds.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And my name is Alan, and we are from ReverseThieves.com. If you have any comments or suggestions for the podcast, you can email them to ReverseThieves@gmail.com or join our Discord and hang out and have conversations there like all the cool podcasts have now.
We have been brought into the future.
Whether we wanted to or not.
I kind of like it.
It's fine. As an old man in my 40s, I got to say that now. It's like a legal requirement.
That's right. We would have to shut down the podcast. This episode of the podcast is kind of a catch-up, catch-all episode, similar to May's episode. But we're going to have some rampant speculation thrown in there just to mix it up a little bit.
But first, I would like to do two things. First, I'd like to have, our Birdie Wing update. Very important. I just want to tell everybody that they've started a school arc. But don't worry, I've seen the episode after the beginning of the school arc, and people have crazy golf powers. So it stays insane, and I'm sure the golf mafia will return.
I refuse to believe that anything more bananas than the episode I just watched could happen at a school, but maybe I'm wrong. I and another person were starting to make like a ranking of ridiculous sort of gambling isn't the right word, although you could do, but like, is there a non-ridiculous gambling series? But we were like ranking, like, I was like, okay, so between Akagi, Hypnosis Mike, Birdie Wing, and Skate the Infinity, like, where do you put them on this, like, spectrum? So that's just something fun for the audience to think about.
You gotta also throw in, like, Kakaguri, one-outs.
How do you rank these things? Because, like, some of them, as now has been revealed a little bit by Birdie Wing, is like, no, the world is predicated on some of the ridiculous things that are happening. So I feel like that's how you have to think, like, how much is like world politics affected by anything that is happening? Anyway, I can't wait to talk about Birdie Wing after it's all over.
But the actual thing that Kate was expecting was the Typhoon Minute. Yay! So, I had a lot of news 2 months ago, and last month I just had a little news. Back to a lot of news. And so, I'm going to just narrow it down to two really interesting things. One, we got a new half-loss belt, which was Traum, which is like a European Three Kingdoms. And we got a bunch of cool new servants. So I know after the last two events, there were a lot of like male NPCs that people were hoping to be turned into characters, but it was mostly like female servants. And then this event was just like, here's a bunch of male servants. And so people who loved male servants were super happy. For like the first banners, the new servants were Charlemagne, who's been actually in the Typhoon universe for a while. He was in like the Fate Extella games, and he's been kind of a popular character that people have been hoping to be in the game for a while. And then another knight of Charlemagne that has been actually in Grand Order for a while is Roland, who's possibly the most famous of the Knights of Charlemagne. His sword, you've probably, if nothing else, you've heard of his sword, Durandal. And then the one female servant in the pack was Kremhild, who's Siegfried's wife, who, like, in, like, certain versions of her lore, after her husband is killed by conspirators, she goes on to seduce Attila the Hun just so she could team up with him to kill her husband's killers. Then they had a second banner where they have a young Professor Moriarty, Don Quixote. And, like, probably the most surprising of all of those, the most surprising was Zhang Ju, who, if you don't know who he is, everybody who probably does know who he is knows who he is for two reasons. One, either they've read Romance of the Three Kingdoms and, like, really has a good recall for the name of characters, or they played Dynasty Warrior, because he's the leader of the Yellow Turbans, who's, like, always the first map that you fight in any Dynasty Warriors game, because the Romance of the Three Kingdoms starts with the Yellow Turban Rebellion, and that's usually where, that's like the big kind of war where most of the major players in Romance of the Three Kingdoms, like, get their first, like, major battle experience, or, like, make allies and enemies and such. So he was an interesting addition, because people kind of expected more of the big names from, you know, the actual Three Kingdoms period. So, like, the leader of the Yellow Turbans was probably nobody's first guess for the next character from Romance of the Three Kingdoms, but I thought it was an interesting choice. And so that's all the grandeur news, but the crazy news is at Comic-Con 100, I think a bunch of the Japanese Typhoon fans just said that Comic-Con 100 might be a war zone, because there are three tables that are going to be right next to each other on the industry day, which are going to be insane. Chikiya Umina, the lady who writes Honey and Clover and March Comes Like a Lion, she's putting out a book there that's all her Oberon art and some other art for Fate. She made the character Oberon for Fate Grand Order. So she's just doing a special book for of just Oberon art at Comic-Con. Then next to her is going to be Arca Wada, who I've mentioned before is now one of the primary Fate Grand Order just Typhoon artists. But every year she's done Fate Grand Order books, but this year she's doing her first all Tsuhime book with the release of Tsukihime remake. And then the kind of third leg that is, like, utterly shocking is Nasu and Takuchi are actually having a booth at Comic-Con alongside the Typhoon booth. Like, they'll have the Typhoon booth, but they'll also just have their own personal booth. And it's, like, the first time they've had a booth at Comic-Con since they've become big and Nasu's kind of become reclusive. So,
well, I was going to say, I thought that maybe I'm misremembering this, Al. Mm-hmm. I thought you had said that nobody even knows what they look like.
Yeah.
So are they actually going to be there, or do they wear, like, a mask or something?
I don't know. That's all a very good question.
Or, like, but you said they've been there before. So,
well, but they've been there before when they were nobody, so.
I see.
And I don't know if Nasu was actually there, Takuchi just sold stuff. I know when, by the time they got to Tsuhime, they had, like, a little bit of a marketing team. And so their original marketing director, like, cosplayed Kohaku and stuff. And she was mostly the person selling stuff at the booth and doing stuff. So by the time they were Typhoon and selling Typhoon stuff, Nasu was already reclusive. It was back when they were Bamboo Broom is when Nasu would actually be at Comic-Con. And they weren't, you know, super well known and all those. Anything they sold then is, like, super expensive because like almost nobody bought it because they were not well known. And so they're going to have basically a typhoon booth and a bamboo broom. So yeah, I'll be very interested if it's just going to be like Takuchi at the table or if Natsu's actually going to make a, you know, appearance or it's going to be like the guy who does like the Nier Automata games that comes in a mask or something like that. I don't know. That's going to be very... I wish I could go to find out, but I...
Or maybe they won't even be at the booth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they'll be people selling stuff that they've made, but they won't be there, or I don't know.
But they will just... But, yeah, it is the first time in years that it's just going to be a bamboo booth, bamboo broom booth that is selling just Natsu and Takuchi stuff that is not, you know, Type Moon. I'm very interested in what they'll be selling there, and, you know, I'm sure there'll be more details as, you know, Comic-Con 100 gets closer, but yeah, all the Type Moon fans in Japan were like, oh man, that's gonna be a war zone, because, like, each one of those people is individually popular, and then when you call it, just you put them all in one little area, and you're basically... I don't know how much the Honey and Clover Lady comes to Comic-Con, but if she does it often, that might be, you know, just people who love her might be just coming there. And, you know, Arkawada is doing something different than she usually does at Comic-Con. And then they're just the people who are going to be there for Type Moon stuff in general. And then all the people who just want to see what Bamboo Broom is doing, you know, for this big 100th. Comic-Con, so I'm definitely after Comic-Con 100, I'm sure there'll be some, you know, reports, and I'll probably put that, the reports of that in the Type Moon moment or minute when it whichever one we've decided that this is called.
I just call it both, but like when I do the show notes,
do a little report of, you know, what was sold there, what people's reactions were.
That's so exciting, but also seems very daunting. I mean, you know, anything I've ever read about Comic-Con and just the kind of lines and the amount of people that show up to it, it always sounds amazing / intimidating. And this just sounds like the next level.
Yeah, man. I mean, I feel like if you're in Japan and you have the time, that is a way if you could, like, you know, I feel like if you could just get some items from there, you could probably make a killing, you know, reselling some of that stuff.
But you know, like, there's going to be people sleeping overnight. Is that a thing you're allowed to do? I don't know. But
I mean, like, I feel like Japan's pretty, just from Hinamatsuri, oddly, weirdly, not this series you'd expect. Like, I mean, Japan is even bigger than U.S. on, like, making the homeless not a visible thing and, like, trying to disappear them and shoo them off where they can't be seen as much as possible. So I feel like if that is the case, then people just, like, sleeping out in the open could be... something they just crack down as a part of that. They'll, like, you know, look the other way for things like people waiting for, you know, stuff. So, I don't know. Yeah, that is a question you have to ask, like, a veteran of Comic-Con.
I look forward to your report on what the conditions were.
Yeah, no, I know a few people on, like, places I you know, look for Type Moon news. Live in Japan, so I'm sure one or two of them will try to at least try to get over there and see what is what. How successful they'll be is quite another question. I will see you next month, Type Lunatics.
So I feel like we did a little birdie wing check-in, so this isn't totally out of nowhere, but we usually talk about, like, things we finished, or, you know, everybody knows how this podcast goes at this point, but I think Al and I really just need an outlet to talk about One Piece for a little bit here, because for those of you who have not been following One Piece recently, the most recent arc seemingly is concluded. Winners were declared in battles, so that's usually a signifier of things. And a lot of stuff happened in this arc that has been going on for... I was trying to remember when the Wano arc started out. It's like mid-2018. It was pre-pandemic, then it was the whole pandemic. We've been in Wano, and it took so long to get to Wano anyway. Like, this whole arc, you know, has been set up for so long.
Because there's the whole arc with the beast people, and then there's the Reverie arc, which still isn't over. Which I was
right.
We totally didn't mention the last time we talked a little about it, and then said we should save it for the podcast. But technically, the Reverie arc isn't over. In fact, it just hit its climax, so...
I think we should say here that there's no way we can talk about this without some spoilers. So, if you don't care about One Piece spoilers, just hang in with us for a few minutes and hear us talk about all of our wild questions. Anyway, the point is, not only did this arc just finish, which is significant and a good reason to talk about it, but the other thing is that Oda has said he's taking a month-long break, which is current right now while we're recording this, and to set up the final storyline of One Piece. Like, One Piece is heading into its final arc. Now, my first theory is that the final arc will take 5 years. So, like, I'm not expecting One Piece to be going anywhere anytime soon. So, like, when he says final arc, there, if you look up the story arcs for One Piece, which I don't like how some of these places do them, but there's, like, arcs within arcs. So, when Oda says it's the final part, I'm sure that it is, but I think it's going to take a long time to get there.
Did you say final arc or final phase?
Maybe phase?
Because that might be two or three. Because I feel like it's going to be more than one arc. I feel like it's the final, like, because I feel like they've got to get to Laugh Tale, and then I feel like there's going to be an arc after that of, like, the fallout from that.
I mean, it could be so many things.
I could be wrong.
Because, no, who knows? I mean, no one can see into the mind of Oda. So anything that we say, I just wanted to, like, be able to talk about some, like, ideas we have about, like, or just, like, let's just list all the things we still need to know about. Like, for him to be like, hey, I'm going to be wrapping this up. I was like, does he have a checklist? Because I have one.
Well, I mean, I think I mentioned on, I definitely mentioned on the podcast before, there's a chapter I always remember and love in Hayate where Squid Girl had just recently ended, and Hayate and Nagi are talking about, like, oh man, when a mangaka wraps up a series, you know, it's such a hard thing because if it's been running for a long time, there are a lot of plot threads that, what do you call it, have to end. And sometimes the mangaka will forget about stuff that the readers definitely haven't. And, you know, it's not as important to the writer to finish, but God, are the fans going to be upset. And, you know, they're talking about Squid Girl, but they're clearly talking also about Hayate, which had recently announced that it was ending, it's, you know, wrapping up things. And so I feel like that chapter always pops into my head now whenever a series is wrapping up. Boy, there are a bunch of things that the writer probably forgot about or was never super important to them, but are amazingly important to the fans. And are like, in fact, I remember Hada had like a poll that he ran online of, like, what are the five most important things that you feel should be wrapped up at the end of Hayate?
Oda strikes me as very meticulous, mm-hmm. even though this story is so... bananas. But, like, you know, this is this type of story where something on a newspaper that somebody is reading is relevant 300 chapters later. You know, I've always talked about this. I always describe Oda as, like, you know, the guy with, like, the pin board with all the, like, the serial killer, you know, like, oh, I have the strings connecting everything. Like, I just feel like he has all of these threads that he seemingly knows what he's doing with. That being said, I mean, does anybody ever wrap up every plot thread? But, like, there's big ones. Like, what is the third weapon? What is Vegapunk up to?
Oh, what's the Will of D? What happened during the Void Century?
Nico Robin and the Poneglyphs. What is the One Piece? A very important one. I have a feeling we're going to know the answer to that. Like, they still have to deal with Blackbeard. We have to deal with Shanks. So my theory there is that, like, Blackbeard is going to kill Shanks, because I think Shanks has to die.
I mean, that wouldn't surprise me.
Although maybe that's too, like, similar to, like, Ace dying, you know, and, like, Ace had to die, but Blackbeard didn't kill Ace, so. Oh, yeah, speaking of people they need to take care of, that guy.
Well, I feel like Blackbeard's still around, so, like, and they've had him pop up every once in a while, so I feel like it's not like he's disappeared, but, yeah, no, he definitely is somebody who still has to,
Oh, no, I meant asshole who killed.
Oh.
Ace.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh.
They, you know, they like, haven't dealt with that. Like, we have to get our last true crew members. Maybe we have them.
Akainu, that was his name. Okoji is the guy with the ice powers. It's the lava power.
Akiji is the ice powers.
Yeah, yeah. Akainu still has to get his. Plus, they're like, I still feel like Enel has to do whatever he has to do on the moon, because that clearly is important. I mean, he's hardly, like, the most critical character, but I feel like the fact that there were, like, people living on the moon and all that stuff, and that can't be just nothing. I feel like that's still clearly going to be important.
Did you already say the Will of D? Like, yes. How are all the D characters, like, related to each other? Now that we are at the end of this arc, I know Al and I were just talking about, like, are the emperors that have been defeated going to be replaced?
Because, yeah, my theory was maybe Luffy is going to be, like, named an emperor, and Trafalgar and or, not Drake, and Kid maybe will be named emperors. Maybe there'll be, like, five emperors now: Shanks, Blackbeard, Luffy, Kid, and Trafalgar.
Oh, man, you know, just even if it's not Kid, I feel like the internet will explode if Trafalgar Law becomes an emperor. Like, there will be much joy. Oh, Joy Boy? Like, we need to, whatever that is?
Yeah, that seems like a rather late piece of the world lore to pop up. I'm sure if I, like, went on the One Piece podcast, I'll be like, here were all the places where Joy Boy was actually hinted at.
Because that's who Oda is, yeah. Oh, how about the guy with the butterfly? Like, the weird...
Oh, yeah, yeah, like the actual head of the world government guy?
Yeah, or just, like, yeah, the world government. Vivi obviously still has to join the crew. Yeah, whatever's going on with the revelry. There is so much, and I'm sure we can continue to list things. And I'm sure other people could list things that we aren't even thinking of. And I just am like, how could this possibly, like, is 5 years even enough? It took 4 years for Wano.
That's why I feel like it's the last phase, not the last arc.
But even if it is the last phase, I mean, how many years are we talking here? You know, like, it.
I'm saying 5 sounds minimal.
Yeah, it's right minimum. Although somebody brought this up. I think I told you this, Al, but I like didn't even occur to me, but somebody was like, oh, what if there's another time skip? And I was like, oh, don't even, what? I didn't it didn't even cross my mind. Because I did feel like at the end of the most recent chapter, it didn't really give us a hint about, like, what was next. You know what I mean?
Well, I feel like with that, you know, new admiral who, like, doesn't eat.
Oh, yeah.
Popping out and, like, going to basically the, you know, the world government guys being like, oh, don't worry, we're going to send them over there. I feel like he's going to basically force them out to the next. Like, they're basically going to, like, maybe we should rest here in Wano. You know, now that the new, you know, leadership of Wano is, you know, super cool with us, we'll, like, rest and relax. And, you know, basically the guy pops in and is like, pew, 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 or whatever crazy, you know, devil fruit or, you know, crazy powers he has, and they basically have to, all right, we gotta get out of here, you know, Wano, you guys, you know, keep on keeping on, and they're like, no, we'll protect you, and they're like, no, we've gotta go, and zoom up to the next arc.
That's a good idea. Yeah, it could be also, I mean, it didn't seem like it, but it could be one of those, like, short, silly arcs mm-hmm. that sometimes Oda throws in, you know, to, like, break up the, like, big stuff. So I guess, I mean, maybe it could be that. One thing I really don't want to see is, you know, when they were coming to Wano, the crew, like, split up for a while. Mm-hmm. And I really do not want to see them split up again. And, like, because, you know, we have, like, ever since the time skip, it's just been, there's been so much separation between the crew ever since then, and I hate it. So I really want them to, like, because I was like, oh, maybe they could cover more of these plot points if they were, like, separated. Like, some people are going to go do this, and some people are going to go do that. But I really realized after I thought of that I really hope that's not in the cards.
So what you're saying is, don't split the party.
Do not split the party. I do not like it.
One thing I also did think, which might spur them into action, is I swear I remember mentioning that the new Admiral Greenbull was at Reverie.
Ooh.
I wonder if something he'll say about, like, maybe seeing Sabo, that, you know, like, I took out that kid Sabo or something like that, might spur them into investigating what happened at Reverie. Yeah, so even if they, what do you call it? Even if they, you know, don't get chased out of there by this Green Bull guy, they might, by something said there, go, and that would give us, like, insight into what happened at Reverie.
I wonder if they'll get a call from Vivi. I think that would be really nice, although I'm trying to remember where the transponder snail is. I do think that the next chapter we're gonna maybe get us a crew splash page, and yeah, maybe we'll have some new crew members on it.
I mentioned this to Kate that one of the rules of One Piece is that anytime anybody officially joins, they have a chapter that's their title. So, like, when Sanji joins, when Nami joins the chapter that she officially, not like when she's traveling, the chapter where in Arlong, after Arlong Park, where she officially joins, is called the third. The one where Zoro joins is called the second. So every crew member that joins, their chapter is, like, what, and, like, some people are technically with the crew for years before, like, I think Nico's Robin's chapter, I forget what number she is only after what do you call it, you know, when they go to Marine Joe and all that. And I swear I remember an old, I've mentioned this before, I've never been able to find it again, this old interview with Oda where he said the last two members will join at the, you know, in the same chapter. So I'm curious if, like, either the next chapter or the chapter after that might be the 9th and the 10th.
Al, what if he never said that and you just had a premonition dream?
Years ago. I really wish that my premonition dreams would be like winning lottery numbers and not random One Piece.
You don't find that useful?
It's cool, I guess, but it's not the most useful premonition dreams I could have. But yeah, my personal bet is that Jinbei and Yamato join at the same time.
I think that the next chapter, I agree that they maybe join in the next chapter and we have the crew in the next, and it's like going to be a splash page. I think not a huge time skip will happen, but I think at least like a few days or something. I think there's going to be some time between the end of the most recent chapter and the beginning of the next chapter. Not like a huge amount of time, mm-hmm. but I feel like maybe there will be a little bit of time.
I think a lot of it depends on how everything goes with Green Bull when he shows up. And like what exactly is, you know, does he just like scare them off, or do they fight him and like then have to just like, you know, do they fight him to a stalemate? Do they like lose but get away? Do they beat him but like have to then know that, what do you call it, if they even though they beat him, they gotta get the heck out of Dodge? And what does he say about what happened to Reverie or any other information he might give?
I feel like something, I don't know, I just feel like it's gotta be something bigger. I don't, maybe that's just my personal, what I want to see, but it just feels like after who they've just defeated, like you're gonna have to do some real convincing to me that like anyone is a threat. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, this is a totally new person that we have never seen before. Like, I have a hard time even caring. Like, I can't even imagine that, like, what could you possibly be bringing to the table that was, like, going to be a threat to Luffy at the level that he's at, you know?
Maybe a Kainu kind of person, but they're, like, well-established.
Right, like, if it was him, right, I'd be like, oh, shit. So I'm very curious, like, yeah, why is it a new person and, like, what is it going to be? I guess that's why I also thought of maybe, like, a funny arc or, like, a silly short arc, like a palate cleanser, basically.
Yeah, and like you said, like, you know, there's Blackbeard and still a bunch of other people running around, so.
And the thing is with Blackbeard, it's like, we really don't know what the heck he's been doing.
Yeah, all we know is that, He stole Whitebeard's, like, earthquake power, and he's gathering a super evil crew, and he's no longer, working for the world government.
Yeah, so it's like, that's obviously the biggest looming threat, but there's just, like, so much other stuff. Oh my gosh, you guys. I'm like, but it's also very exciting, right? To hear, I don't know, like, it's always, I think it's interesting because I feel like it's both happy and sad when you hear something is going to be ending. Or at least I shouldn't speak for other people. I think it's really exciting, but also sad, but like, I'm kind of more excited about it. Like, My Hero Academia is in its final phase, arc, whatever you want to call it, and it's like very exciting to know, like, we're coming towards we're rocketing towards a conclusion.
Well, I feel like One Piece is very clearly near the, like, it feels very much like the final confrontation, as it were, whereas I feel like One Piece, I'm like you said, both of us agree that, like, 5 years seems like almost the rushed ending.
Yes. Well, but it is, I think it's also kind of exciting that One Piece is, I mean, I'm getting ahead of myself because it's not actually finished yet, but like, One Piece is a series that's started after I became a fan and became this juggernaut shonen, you know, staple, right? It's so popular. It's so ubiquitous. It's so, like, significant. And it's been running the whole such a long time. But, like, I'm also going to get to see the end of it, which is very exciting. So, but we won't see the end of it until I'm, like, much older. I could be retired by then.
Old Lady Kate will, what do you call it, enjoy, what do you call it, One Piece surrounded by her grandchildren.
Oh, I hope not. But I will definitely, no matter how old I am, I feel like I will come to the internet to, like, spill all of my feelings about One Piece. And one thing it doesn't have to wrap up, thankfully, is, like, it doesn't have any, like, romantic entanglements that we have to deal with, which is great. Like, I'm so glad that I won't have to hear, like, any sort of, like, ship arguments about this series. I mean, not that people don't ship people, but I doubt that anyone is really expecting any sort of conclusions to those ships. Just me?
I mean, there'll be, I think it's one of those things, there'll be shipping battles and shipping wars at the end, or people who will be upset that, like, you know, people who read into their mystical Oda Dakota rings that, like, clearly they were, this couple was the destined couple the whole time, but he didn't have the guts. You know, you coward, Oda, why didn't you pull the trigger of the relationship I knew you wanted the whole time? And it's like, projection much? But yeah, it won't be like one of those fandoms like, you know, like Hayate or one of those other ones where, like, people just spend years just arguing about how, like, the series ended properly or incorrectly.
I mean, I can't think of, like, a recent shonen series that didn't have that. Naruto, Bleach, My Hero Academia, you know, is gonna have it, right? Like, there's gonna be some salty people about their ship. Maybe Demon Slayer?
Yeah.
But the anime isn't over yet, and so people could get salty there.
I was about to say, I know why, but I'm like, people are really gonna be salty at the end of My Hero Academia. I don't see why they would be, but I know they will be.
I mean, come on, Al. You've been in this long enough to know.
Oh, yeah. It's like, part of Al is like, I thought the ships in this series were pretty damn obvious. And then part of me was like, Al, you silly, silly summer child.
That's so cute, Al, that you thought that. But yeah, like, I welcome that One Piece, it doesn't have it. Or at least it doesn't have it to the extent that others will have it, because all of those other series actually dabble in romance, where, like, One Piece says zero. Is 0% romantic. It's just not even a thought in any of the characters' minds. All right, we gotta get off the One Piece talk. We could talk about it for literally ever, because there is so much to talk about. I even like, while we were just talking about this, I thought of, like, three or four other things that I want answers to, and, like, I'm not even gonna list them here because, like, it could just go on all night. Come to the Discord, let us know your One Piece theories, let us know what you really want to know the answers to, and tell us your One Piece ships.
I ship them all with adventure, Kate, just like Oda.
Right, or maybe you could just tell us your favorite actual physical ship, like actual boats.
I see.
I'm still, you know, the Thousand Sunny is great, but the Going Merry makes me cry every time when I think about it. All right, so moving on.
Since we got the long amount of One Piece talk out of the way, I figure we'll do what the actual episode is about.
I feel like we're not going to talk about any show on this episode more than we just talked about One Piece.
I think it's interesting that the shows we're going to talk about, because we have two TV shows to wrap up and then one like movie. Well, the problem is I don't think we had as strong a feeling about any of these as we do about One Piece, which is not super surprising, but I feel like they're all worth talking about. But yeah, no, we're probably going to go by a lot quicker. I'm going to talk a little bit about Blade Runner Black Lotus.
Or as I abbreviated in my notebook, Blade Runner BL. And I was like, such disappointment, possibly. Or maybe you're going to tell us that that is accurate.
I mean, there are two characters, you guys, who can ship. They kind of have like this old friendship / antagonism, which is like kind of, you know, the perfect fodder for a certain type of BL fan. I guess not my cup of tea. But, you know, to each their own, I suppose.
Sorry, audience. I will refrain from abbreviating it in such a way.
I feel like if you worry, it is not an unpopular Fujiyoshi type of pairing. So I guess you could if you were so...
I know, but that makes it sound like it's...
Oh, yeah.
You know, the focus. Mm.
Plus, if there's anything that has a BL focus, we'll get to that later in the in the podcast. So, yeah, let's not misdirect all the BL fans where they should be going if they're gonna watch one of the shows that we recommend. So I thought it was interesting. So it is that, you know, very kind of janky. Japanese CG, it's no Beastars or Land of the Lustrous. I think it's better than some of the previous outings, but it still like strays a little too far into the uncanny valley and like stiffness. Like I'm like, who knows, maybe in a decade this will actually be something acceptable to look at. But I think this will also come up. I could kind of get around kind of janky animation if, like, the story is interesting enough. And I've kind of been a Blade Runner fan for a while. Not a huge Blade Runner fan, but I like the original movie. I like, you know, the new 2049. The little Watanabe short that they made, the Blackout one, was really good. But, you know, that's Shinichiro Watanabe. You know, his stuff is always going to be excellent. And I will say that story-wise, it was serviceable. It's the best way I can put it. Like, it is a very by-the-books revenge story where you have the person wants to get revenge. They have to find out, you know, who are the people that, you know, did her dirty and, you know, did other people dirty. Find out the full story. There is a twist. You know, she has a mentor who has a, you know, sordid past and is somewhat connected. You know, there's a dragon, if you want to use the TV tropes, you know, for the bad guys that is constantly harrying her every step of the way. So, I mean, in that regard... I don't feel like it. Does anything? It performs the formula well. I can't complain about the way it does it. It also is just the most by the numbers way to do it. So in that regard, it's not going to super stand out. I do find. There is a cop lady who is like determined to get to the truth, and she kind of like oscillates between like trying to stop our main character and then L, and then you know kind of then, you know, learning more and then trying to see what was going on and then not being an ally, but, you know, at least being like a secondary protagonist until certain events. And then, so she was probably the most different thing, but I've seen that archetype of a character before, but, you know, the detective that's against them, you know, because when they find out more truth, you know, kind of, what do you call it, is not as determined to go on with the hunt. And so even that part is not groundbreaking or amazingly unexpected. But the thing that why I really wanted to bring it up is what was most shocking to me was that in many ways it's like a backdoor origin story for Jared Leto's character in the 2049 movie and like how he got to the position that he is and how he got to like the plans that he has and like why he's blind in that movie. And so in many ways it's like a amazingly canonical story. I think one or two people have complained about like certain continuity errors it makes, but I didn't look into them. And I'm also, as I said, I like Blade Runner, but I'm not like enough of a fan to like, clearly this would not line up with this part. If somebody really cares, they can school me in the comments about what it was. But it didn't seem like, I didn't see anything that was majorly off. Maybe that's just because I'm not thinking about enough or not enough of like a deep Blade Runner lore person. But I just thought it was very interesting. And then now that I think about it, even Blackout, I forgot the year in that one, you know, the Shichiro Watanabe is like amazingly integral. I mean, they explain enough in the movie that you don't need to have seen it, but essentially all the events in that are canonical and basically part of the Blade Runner universe. So it's just interesting that they let those two anime like essentially be as official canon as any of the live action movies, which is just, I don't know, it's just a little unusual. I feel like usually, like, no, I don't think anybody is surprised that, like, I'm pretty sure none of the Star Wars Vision shorts that we saw are considered super canonical parts of the Star Wars universe.
I wonder if it's sort of an acknowledgement of anime's
influence and
sort of like its relation to cyberpunk or something, you know? Because I was thinking about I watched like a couple of episodes of this, and then when you're just talking about it now, I was thinking about how obviously like early on cyberpunk was like this aesthetic that like a lot of anime fans like gravitated towards. And, like, you thought, I feel like for a brief period, you thought, like, cyberpunk would be ascendant. Like, you always think of, like, it's going to have its time, but, like, it never, like, obviously, there's some really great movies that are the cyberpunk aesthetic and, like, some anime also. But, like, it never became, like, dominant.
I mean, there is the old joke that's not a joke that everybody says that, what do you call it? Cyberpunk isn't as relevant anymore because we just live in the cyberpunk dystopia. We just don't have any of the cool parts. We just have all the most horrific dystopian parts of the cyberpunk universe
without the flying cars.
Cars and like cool cybernetic implants. Yes. It's just like, oh, we got all the corporate control and like digital, control that, you know, the cyberpunk series were all warning us about, but they gave it to us in a pleasant enough guise
that we just accepted it all.
I was listening to some video essay, and they were mentioning this kind of famous tweet that somebody made. Science fiction writer writes a book called The Torment Engine about this, you know, horrible device that would enslave humanity. And what do you call it? And the book is called For the Love of God, Don't Make the Torment Device. And then, like, the next tweet is like a modern day tech company. Hey guys, we finally made the torment device from the book. Please, for the love of God, don't make the torment device a reality. Yay! certain tech companies almost seem to fetishize what was otherwise warnings in some of these sci-fi books. I know, I just thought it was very interesting. I don't think it's like a trend, like you're going to see a lot of other, like, the anime tie-in is official canon,
But also, to be fair, it's still ancillary material. It's not like you can't watch 2049 without these things, so.
No, it's just that it is a level of control, especially considering it comes from, like, a major studio that I would not have normally expected. So in that regard alone, it's worth talking about. I don't think it's like, now because of that, what do you call it? You must see Blade Runner Black Lotus. And it's like mediocre CG and pretty okay plot. But I thought it was worth at least talking about on the podcast for what a unusual little situation that was.
Well, speaking of things that we watched that I guess were okay, we watched the recent release on Netflix of Bubble, which is a, you know, one-shot movie original, and it has this stellar staff. I actually didn't even realize until I started watching it, because I just hadn't paid enough attention. It was just like Netflix was advertising to me a lot. And then, like, I had vaguely remembered, you know, like, hearing about it. So I was like, oh, let's go ahead and watch that. And then once the credits started rolling, I was like, wow. So we have Gennaro Bucci. He wasn't the only writer on this, but he was like the main writer. We have Obata doing the character designs, you know, of Death Note fame and such. We have Wit Studio doing the animation. We have Suwano doing the soundtrack. And I had to look up the director. That was like the only person that didn't stand out to me, who is Tetsuro Araki. But he like did the first three seasons of Attack on Titan. He did Kabunari Iron Fortress and like Guilty Crown. So like, I feel like you can, like, whatever you think about those things, I have opinions, but, like, you can kind of see his style, I think. Mm-hmm. I think those things, like, immediately you can sort of see sort of the style of the direction.
He's definitely a competent director in, like, putting a scene on the stage and having it have style.
That being said, though, I feel like we've seen this happen plenty of times in the past, and it's almost a joke, I think, at this point, where if you get too many, like, great people together, it always ends up being sort of okay, but, like, I mean, sometimes it's really bad, but...
Kate had suggested that we watch it, and I remember, like, okaying it, and then just, like, coincidentally, not that long after, seeing like three or four people just blast Bubble as being like visually beautiful, but like otherwise awful. So I went in with like super low expectations, expecting almost kind of like, and I know people really like this, but kind of like a Tenkan Concrete or Dead Leaves, where it's like visually amazing, but like, I go away like, because like, I don't like find any kind of like core narrative to latch on. It just seems like it's more obsessed with its visuals than like telling any story, or like telling it amazingly abstract story. Yeah, I wonder how much all my opinion comes from greatly lowered expectations of all these people saying, like, there was not even like, I just didn't like it. And it didn't, when Kate mentioned how many people have, you know, big name people worked on, I'm like, oh, you had amazingly high expectations from this series. And so when it is what it was, you got amazingly disappointed.
Because, like, it just feels like all these people came together, but none of it all, like, it doesn't feel like it all goes together. I think that's, like, what the problem is. Like, we have, like, we've got, like, a post-apocalyptic future Tokyo where the economy runs on parkour games. And, like, and there's this, I wouldn't call it a disease, this phenomenon, you know, has created this kind of weird space where, like, the outside world is pretty much functioning as normal, but inside the bubble, all these bubbles appeared, and, like, it changed sort of, like, gravity and, like, the way space works. And first, you know, it was, like, kind of cordoned off, and then, like, people retook it, but again.
Well, they kind of explained that, like, it became, like, there were so many orphans that were made because of, like, the bubble disaster in Tokyo, that a bunch of the kids who were tired of, like, living in, like, the kind of orphanage system, like, ran away to, like, kind of, like, live like brave street rats in the cordon off Tokyo, which really makes me wonder, especially after, like, Penguin Drum, there has to be, like, some kind of serious issues with the Japanese, like, social systems regarding orphans, because it is something I've repeatedly seen as a, like, topic that comes up in anime. I mean, as someone who is not Japanese or, like deeply studying them, like, from a cultural anthropology angle, I'm not sure I could tell you what it is, but it does. I am curious if anybody does know of, like, anybody who has examined that, whether outside of Japan or in Japan, because it definitely seems like it's, like, an issue that keeps coming up.
Hmm. It only gets a brief mention in here, but...
And in many ways, it's just an excuse why you can have these parkour gangs.
Yes. And Hibiki is part of one gang, and he's sort of, like, their best player, and he's kind of aloof, you know, just disconnected, but he... And he also has a sensory... I don't know how to exactly say it, but, like, he's, like, extremely sensitive to sound. Mm-hmm. So he wears headphones to sort of block out some of the sound because it, like, overwhelms him. But he hears this song when he is in the bubble, and when he kind of goes to investigate, he ends up... Some stuff happens. He meets a girl who, like, appears out of the bubbles and saves him, and then she sort of becomes part of the found family. They allegedly fall in love. Sorry, I didn't believe in their love. And they also win against parkour gangs, and also maybe there's aliens that are...
Oh my. I mean, it's highly implied that the bubble things are aliens. I think the biggest flaw of the whole thing is, like, easily addressed by that, is... It very much felt like they had a bunch of cool set pieces and set ideas, and then just did the bare bones to have a story to connect it all together, which was essentially, what do you call it? Take the Little Mermaid and mix it with the parkour opening of The Office. And then there is your setting and story.
feel like the Little Mermaid aspect of it, I mean, look, I understand. As a person who misses themes all the time and, like, doesn't, you know, I can appreciate stating something a little more outright, like, here's our inspiration. But it's one movie. I don't think they need to just state it, like, the three or four times. It was like, they read The Little Mermaid, then she starts calling him the prince, and, like, I mean, it was just, like, so many things. And it was like, you could just, I got it.
All they did do was have, like, the scientist lady go, you know.
She probably did say whatever you're about to say.
You know, I feel like one of the major themes of the story we're living through is The Little Mermaid.
Like, I'm pretty sure she might have actually said that. Uta, the girl who comes out of the bubbles, Uta means song. I know you guys are on, I'm spoilers, guys. She was singing the song. But then Utakata means bubble. I did not know this. Obviously somebody that I know who knows Japanese was like, oh, I see what they're doing here. She's this character who has, like, no experience with the world, but she's, like, a teenage girl. And I feel like, I think the problem with the romance in my mind is that, like, they wanted me to, like, really believe in their, like, deep love, but she's, like, she's kind of more like a pet.
Yeah, I mean, it does fall a lot into some of the more problematic elements of the born sexy yesterday trope. Where, like, it's like, ah, there's this character who's, what do you call it? You know, I mean, she's usually, like, sexy hot, but, you know, attractive. But what do you call it? Since they are just, like, practically a newborn, you know, they don't know about things like, we call it, you know, what is this emotion you call love?
Or like, oh, I'm not supposed to just, like, touch you or whatever. Like, I mean, or get naked or whatever. Yeah,
like, getting naked is the common.
Typical.
I don't think she actually did that one.
No, no. In fact, I mean, I feel like the movie doesn't really have a lot of overt fan service in it. There is the scientist lady a little bit, but, like, otherwise, it's not like a lot, I feel like, so.
Yeah, I think they just have, like, a bikini at one point to just, like, you know, get a tan and something. And, I mean, she's pretty well endowed in general. But, yeah, there's not, like, a lot of lingering va-va-va-boom shots of her.
And I didn't feel like it was trying to be, like, that they had this, like, lust for each other. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like it was supposed to be sort of this more, like, pure love, but I just felt like she just felt like such a child. I mean, not that Hibiki was like some mature person, but I don't know, it just like that I felt like wasn't working for me in the narrative, and I just like it was hard for me to make that connection between like see that connection between them as a they almost had like more to me they almost had like a almost like a sibling feeling to them. You know, that's just my personal takeaway from it. I will give the series props for bringing back Tokyo Tower as a major set piece, because I was like, oh, look at this. It reminds me of the 90s. Like, when was the last time this happened? There's no Tokyo Sky Tree, and, like, taking away all of the you know, like,
glory of yeah. the Tokyo Tower.
Yeah. As a place where magical stuff happens.
Yeah, that was unusual. I did like the gimmick of like the leader of the villain team. How they like have to use a voice box.
We've seen a lot of extreme sports. Like, right? Like that's like kind of a popular thing right now in anime. So I feel like that's also something they were trying to do with the parkour thing. Where it's like, it's future extreme sports stuff. And it was like, there were no stakes. Like, it didn't feel like there were real stakes for what they were setting up with that. So I found that pretty boring. Also because our main team, so Uta joins their team, right? At, like, Hibiki's team. And they're like, yeah, you know, like, woo. But, like, Hibiki's team is never, like, they're never shown to be weak. Like he's awesome. They never lose in the series, or sorry, they never lose in the movie. So I didn't feel like,
again, the only time that all came close to losing was when the villain team comes out and they have their like slick, like, you know, parkour tech.
Right.
And but then they have Uta and they just.
But it just, I felt like to make that, you know, that narrative work, I feel like they should have been more like a down on their luck team, you know, because it's like, well, why did they really even need her? Like, you guys were winning, I mean, and then you had the potential to lose, but then didn't. So, like, I felt like there was not a lot of tension there, but then.
Or if they had, like, they were always winning, then, like, Team Tech Guy beats them, and then. They, with Uta, they make a comeback.
Right. Like, that's what I felt like it needed, because I didn't think it had enough tension. And then I can appreciate that they wanted to have, like, they had, like, an A plot and a B plot, sort of, but I didn't feel like the parkour part really, like, connected to the bubbles and, like, the...
Yeah, it just seemed like, yeah, there were just two elements that were connected by Hibiki was part of both of them.
Right? Like, it just, I felt like they could have done a better job of somehow sort of, like, meshing those storylines. Like you said, Al, I feel like they did the bare, I thought that was a good way of putting it. They did the bare minimum of, like, connecting everything, but I don't think it ends up being, like, very satisfying or... engaging.
Well, it's also just very telling. Like, why did the bubbles come to Earth in the first place? Why did they do the things they did? Why does anything at the end happen? Unimportant. It seemed like the series, like, it wasn't even like one of those things where it felt like the mystery was, you know, like, one of the major important themes or thing. It was like, it'll always be a mystery. Because sometimes, like, not explaining stuff is part of the theming or part of the story. It just seemed like they did not care enough to explain it. It was like, yeah, this is important. It happened so we could get these scenes to happen and this romance to happen. And then, you know, get the conclusion we happen. You want deeper explanations for why any of these things happen? I don't know. That's what fanfiction's for. See ya.
Because I felt like the ending and everything, the plot in the ending, it just feels like tacked on to, like, the rest of the... Even though I know that, like, the bubbles created this space, I feel like it didn't feel like any of that was, like, relevant to, like, most of the story. And then it becomes, like, oh, we have to have this big, like, dramatic looking conclusion to this, but we didn't think about how that works with the rest of it. I don't know. Yeah, it was very mid, you guys.
Oh man, you're starting to use it now. You're a cool kid. Unlike me, I don't use mid. I'm old. Not the worst thing in the world to watch, but it also is not, it's not like Redline. You gotta, just because Redline recently came up. Of so like, good. You're gonna like proselytize and like, oh, you gotta see the animation in the story and, you know, these characters and this. And it's like, oh yeah, I've also seen Bubble.
And like, I know that everybody's praising the animation and like, Wit is obviously very talented, but I wasn't overwhelmed by the, like, a couple of scenes, maybe. I thought, wow.
I do also feel like some of the parkour scenes were very well animated. So, like, there's nothing technically wrong with the movie. It's just, it is lesser than the sum of its parts.
Totally. And I feel like Suwano, I feel like of all the things, to me, he was just totally wasted on this soundtrack. Like, I don't think I would, not that I'm a big music person and, you know, really follow that so well, but... If I hadn't just saw his name attached to it, I don't think I would have thought, oh, this is one of his soundtracks. So I feel like, yeah, it just wasn't, you know, it doesn't live up to all the people working on it. But I feel like that is not uncommon.
I also feel like, I'm not sure if I gave it
a better review because I didn't have any expectations? Or did people give it a worse review because they had such high expectations? But yeah, overall, I was just like, that was something that happened.
We're going to wrap things up with a show that's, I think we're going really far back.
Ancient.
In anime years, ancient. Last year, I think, was when it came out. Al talked about this show. I think you didn't talk about the finishing it, but I think you talked about like an early review of it.
Because we hadn't reviewed it for like the season review, and I was just like, I want to watch a few episodes. And I was just kind of a little, I was caught off guard by some of the elements of said isekai series. And I guess that intrigued Kate.
Yeah. Al, I feel like you think I don't listen to you or something. But it's like, I was like, I don't know, this might be one that you will like. So I did end up checking out and finishing the first season of Faraway Paladin.
And I just want to point out, just in case the viewers don't know, there is a certain, at least minimum mark of quality if Kate finishes a show.
I think so.
It doesn't mean the show is great or good, but it just means Kate did not just go, this would be a waste of my time to finish, and I will not go any farther.
I think our listeners know that I will tap out at any time, even if there's only like 2 episodes left of something. Like, no, I'm not wasting an hour of my life watching this. So,
as we were mentioning with Moriarty the Patriot.
I don't know if I'm ever going to get back to it. Like, I just don't know if I can. But anyway, so as Al mentioned, Faraway Paladin is an isekai series, but it doesn't factor in too much to the story.
I know I mentioned it to Kate in real life, but I don't remember if I mentioned it on the podcast. But it so much feels like a series that was originally just supposed to be a straight up fantasy series. And like the editor said, if you want this series to be popular, you've got to put some isekai elements in it. And so like, it just feels like all the isekai is just tapped on because isekai is the thing to do with fantasy.
I mean, I can see what you're saying. I would say my only, this is not even a counter to that, Al. It's more of a further investigation, I would say. Mm. But like, so the thing that kept me watching this show was it really gave me classic JRPG vibes a little bit. In its kind of execution and its world. And, like, I feel like the way the isekai is in here kind of reminds, like, there are classic JRPGs that sort of have that element, the way that they use it in here, where it's, like, you're reborn or, like, you can sort of remember the past. And, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like, obviously, isekai is super popular, and I think that you're right that they were like, well, we have to capitalize. Like, we can capitalize on that. But I do think that there is also, like, a history of it in games and, like, you know, it's not like isekai was invented 10 years ago or whatever. True. And we all know that. But, like, I just feel like that's what kept me in it was that JRPG feel.
I feel like usually maybe it's just, like, for better or for worse, the author felt like it should be done differently, or like there are other explanations. And like if you saw an interview with the original author, maybe they'd almost certainly have much more insight. But like part of it always seems like the fantasy of you're dissatisfied with your life, your regular life, and here's like this idea that you could be whisked away to like a cooler world where things were better. Did I mention that I finished on the podcast that I finished Land of Lidal? I mean, like that show, even like, you know, the girl is like paralyzed and only living on life support, and like she has to get into MMORPGs because she can't even like leave the hospital room she's in. And like, so when she like dies and goes to the game, it's almost like, well, actually, this is kind of cooler, better. And like, if like, there's like a little bit of an element of that in this, because like there is like, and maybe like later seasons or later books go into it, but like the main character very clearly was
dissatisfied
with some part of their life. We don't know what that part of their life is.
But I do feel like in here, at least, they're not, like, reborn in the game world. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're reborn in a fantasy world, which, like, is also totally part of isekai. A lot, plenty of isekai. But I feel like it didn't, even though I just said it reminded me of a classic JRPG, it didn't remind me of playing a video game. Like, it just, it didn't, it was just a fantasy series, like you said, that had a few of these elements.
But I feel like it's usually so much more of a focus and part of like the fantasy appeal, whereas this one, it just seemed like a very minor element that barely plays it up. Or like, man, wouldn't it be great to be whisked to this world and be in this position?
I mean, I don't know. I feel like the story is kind of tragic, so I don't know if it feels like...
I just feel like the average isekai story, that is the...
Oh, you're saying that about... that, but not this one.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yes. Yes, okay, I agree. Sorry, I agree with that. I think in here, though...
Yeah, because it's such a minor part, and it, yeah, it does seem like such a, like, element of, like, sadness. The only other one that has that same element that I can think of is... Well, actually two, and they're kind of the ones I like, interestingly enough, is Ascendancy of a Bookworm, where she's like, you know, she's in a, in her opinion, a worse situation because it's a world where books are so rare and only like the most elite nobles can really own any books. And like, it's often mentioned that like, she super misses her mom and like, you know, like is sad. It's not like, I'm never going back to my shitty world. I'm going to, you know, live it up here in this cool alternate world. Like, she's actually, she eventually, like, comes to regard the people who raised her in this world as, like, her other family and, like, just as important as her family back home. But, like, it's even mentioned once or twice in this current season that, like, she still very much misses her mom and is sad that, like, you know, that she'll never get to see her again and talk to her again. And, you know, she was like a very positive influence in her life and, you know, is like just heartbroken that at a certain level she'll always, you know, that her mother lost a daughter and she lost a mom. And that is always the way that that will be. And I think on Log Horizon there's a little bit of the same, like we're all very sad that we're cut off from our, well, depends on the character, and there's a much wider range of some people like, I totally embrace this. Some people like, I wish I could get home yesterday. And, you know, other people have mixed feelings. But, yeah, I feel like most of the time it's like a power fantasy or escapist fantasy. Whereas, yeah, there's a lot more tragedy and not like this is the greatest thing that ever happened to this guy.
I mean, obviously he's very powerful, but I also thought it was interesting that he's born as a baby. Like, he grows up here. He grows up with these people. He's not like, I wake up and I'm 15 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, we actually see him, like, growing with this very strange, seemingly very strange family that he is with that are, like, undead, types of undead. And there's no other humans around. And, like, him training. And I don't know. Like, I felt like there was, like, this really beautiful, like, family story going on. And then, like, a big thing happens, and then he has to go out into the world, and I like that we actually got to see all of those elements, because I thought it added a lot to his character, especially, but also kind of grounding that feeling of, like, the journey, and he's way more powerful. That's the only difference I would say for me. He's way more powerful than you would be in a JRPG. I feel like what would happen is all the stuff with his family would happen. The big bad guy would appear and then he'd find out all this stuff. And then he, like, his weapons would be like destroyed or something, and then you have to go on the journey and like relearn it all or whatever, which doesn't really happen here, right? He's still really powerful and he goes out into the world, and it's like a different, it's a different story from there. But like, that's, I think, again, that's where it like really felt like, oh, this like reminds me of a classic game.
One part that is interesting is I forget what the actual Japanese name is, but I kind of see why they named it the Faraway Paladin in the, or at least in the English version, because it does feel like he's trying to bring back this like forgotten light, basically the goddess that he pledges himself to at some point is kind of like barely, mostly forgotten, hardly even worshipped anymore, and like trying to return her teachings and light.
And bringing hope back to like
this kind of world that pretty much went through a magical apocalypse and like people survived, but basically almost have half given up.
And I feel like there's a lot of cynicism, and, you know, the character that, I mean, they become, they end up having a little party that he travels around with, but the big character that he meets, Menel, you know, is somebody who's trying to survive in the world. So, like, I feel like, yeah, that's, like, the contrast of, you know, them being the team, the, like, how they meet, and, like, this, like, Will's like optimism about the world and how like he can be taken advantage of a little bit, like as the politics started to come weave into the like story a little bit later. And like, I feel like it's not, I don't know. It's just like unexpected, I think. And I know that Al brought this up, and it's been brought up a lot about the series, about like the BL like aspects. But I would say, I mean, just like my watch of it, I felt like this was not a queer baiting series. Like, I didn't feel like they were characters falling on each other and like blushing. I mean, they completely skip the bath. There's like a bath. They go to a public bath like all the guys do, and it's like skipped. Like, they didn't even. So I do feel like, even though you can totally, like, look, I believe in Will and Menel's love, okay? Like, but I don't feel like the series is saying one, like, I don't feel like they're queer. I guess that's what I already said. I don't think they're queer baiting.
I wonder how much this is me just reading into things that aren't there. But I do wonder if the thing, because he makes a big deal about being like
an Will?
Will, remembering what little he remembers of his previous life, like being an outsider, like
I think disappointing his family or something. Thing. There's definitely some tension with between his family.
And like hoping to like redeem himself. And I ponder how much. It's basically like, I wonder how much it's hinting at that he was homosexual in his original life and like somehow thought that as deviant and wrong, and that somehow he feels like he's coming to this world to make up for that fact. And kind of the overall lesson was that that was his wrong feeling, and that like he came to this world and perhaps realized that that wasn't wrong. That was supposed to be the lesson. But none of that is explicitly said, and that might be me reading into things that aren't there.
I feel like we know so little that you can read into so much. But I do feel like I don't feel like there's any overt romance in the series in any direction. So
the only thing, like I said in the previous one, is just everything about his elf friend is coded for, in my opinion, what would be the female romantic lead. And, you know, basically Will is the male romantic lead. And what do you call it? Menel is, like, so coded to be the female romantic lead that, like, it does not have to be that way. But it easily could be read that way, considering how much Menel is just
slotting into what would be, if it was a female character, you're like, oh, you're the main romantic lead. You're, these two characters will end up together because that is, with all these events that happen, that is what will happen with these two characters.
Okay, that's totally fair. I mean, in terms of like tropes, what we expect in a party of of characters, I can totally see what you're saying there.
I don't feel like that guarantees that will be the end game of the series. And like, there does seem to be some like blonde girl that's interested in him from the church.
I vaguely remember this person. Oh, yeah, I kind of, yeah, vaguely.
So if they wanted to throw him a hetero romance, they could throw him that girl. But by the fact that how much do you remember her interactions with Will, and how much do you remember Menel's interactions?
All of them, but that's because Menel's like the secondary protagonist, basically, starting once they meet. I feel like we get so much of like, I mean, they could just be like, what a perfect comparison. Sabakui Bisco, the totally most straightest show ever. Like, but like, I mean, they could just be like partners and, right?
No,
but
yeah, like, no.
But I think you could, I totally agree with you, or I totally see what you're saying, that like it could be read in a different, way. I just think, so far in the show, it has not done anything or had them, like, they haven't, I feel like, said anything that could be misinterpreted or said that I love you, like, or, like, or had any, like, blushing or, like, oh, and we're getting into close, you know, like, just stuff that you see, even in shows that I love that are, like, definitely queer baiting. Like, I feel like this show could be 100% queer, or it could be a romance, like it could not be romance, like there was no romance in it, or there could, be some sort of later on, like, het romance, I don't know, but I didn't feel like the first season really had any romance, so, I mean, I know what I'm rooting for, obviously.
I mean, yeah, it did seem like it was just like, The super strong friendship of, you know, a human paladin and his, you know, somewhat, what do you call it, darker elf companion. Elf ranger. Does it not hurt that, what do you call it, Menel's elven ranger cape?
I mean, just props. Good job, everybody. And I think we were saying this before, though, Alice, like, it's not great, but I found something really, like, I really enjoyed watching it. And, like, something kept making me come back to it.
It was definitely not the animation in the background.
Oh, my God. I swear. Did the animation budget, like, evaporate? Like, what happened? I mean, it didn't go full, like, Violetus and Pomelin or whatever. But the last couple episodes are bad. Like, I once I saw that, I was super surprised to then find out it was getting another season, because I felt like it was like,
I wonder if people liked the story and it just had like production or time, like maybe somebody very integral got sick or died or something like that. And it just,
I mean, it did have a recap episode, like around like 7 or 8, I think. That usually indicates production issues for sure. Especially for something so short.
So it might have not been that, like, you know, like, it just wasn't getting, like, the ratings or the budget. Or, you know, it just might have been, like, something bad happened behind the scenes or some kind of mismanagement. And, like, basically, they just fell behind and just, like, kind of creeped over the finish line. But, you know, people still like what they store of the story. Other people were like, I want to see these two kids hook up. Just like, hey.
I feel like it just had like a good, overall good vibe. It wasn't amazing. I definitely wouldn't, you know, but yeah, like I said, I feel like it kept me interested. And I marathoned it. Like I watched it like maybe over the course of like a week or something, where I just like watched a few episodes every day.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting.
not the best isekai I've seen, but oh, not the worst at all. At all. Like, one that I would also watch the second season of. So I thought it was, and I thought it had some, like, interesting, like, elements. And now that, you know, I've analyzed myself on this podcast, I think I actually like the isekai stories where it's not, like, pure wish fulfillment. Like, I go over to the cool world and it's the awesomest thing. I think I like the, like, a little more melancholy, like, version, like, with Log Horizon, Ascendancy of a Bookworm in this one.
I mean, except for My Life as a Villainess. Because that world is pretty good. But yes, Faraway Paladin, I'd recommend it. And I am really looking forward to the second season. And I think that it's maybe a series that the second season is going to see a bump in the budget, because it might have been something where they weren't necessarily sure if it was going to be popular, but it seemed like it gained a following. Even after it came out, it felt like it was kind of keeping going a little bit. So, I mean, Will's a pretty good boy and Minnell's nice and grumpy. So, like, yeah, I'm glad I took a chance on this one. So, that's another isekai. I should just really keep track of, like, all of them.
The handful of isekai that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
The list.
All right. So that wraps up another episode of the Speakeasy podcast. I think there will be another podcast in July before we're at Otakon. But I'm just reminding you all that we will be there. So if you're going to be there, we'll have some panels. And hope to see many of you at the con. If you can make it out.
Yeah, see you guys at Otakon.